Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we are talking with Isiru Senavaratna. He is a managing partner with Radiant Value, a sustainable investment advisor based in New York City. And as an amateur investor myself, it seems that all investments should be sustainable. Addressing climate change is going to cost a lot, in the trillions of dollars. And parenthetically, even though addressing climate change costs a lot, research shows that it will cost more to not address it. The money has to come from somewhere. Governments cannot come close to this kind of money for both political and financial reasons. So where else? Investment from the private sector, carefully encouraged, directed, and regulated by government, is the only answer. So let's get a professional investment advisor's thoughts on this. Here we go. Isiru Senavaratna, welcome to Climate Talk.
Thanks for having me, John.
So I think one of the things that those of us who are concerned about the future of the climate often talk about, we're pretty comfortable talking about, is talking about the science, talking about the technology, what works, what doesn't work, so on and so forth. And it seems like what things cost gets pushed into the background sometimes, especially from what I would call maybe the left of center perspective. I think right of center people are, this is a subject that they're comfortable with and that they do want to talk about, but it's just not a general subject. So you have some background in finance and the environment. So could you sketch that out a little bit, where you're coming from that perspective?
Sure. Yeah. My finance background is in energy investments. So I spent a lot of time looking at oil and gas investments. I've been to some coal mines. And then I set up my own investment shop in 2015. And I started looking at clean tech side of the things as well. So I've been chasing energy storage for about not a decade, but close to, and kind of the resources and the technologies that go into the clean energy future that we all desire, and the economics thereof. Like, how, you know, in order to make an investment, I mean, we were, and I continue to be a long-term value investor. So it's not kind of playing the fluctuations of the stock market on a daily basis, but trying to understand long-term investment trends and evaluate which investment classes or companies are undervalued, underappreciated by the rest of the investor group.
So just out of curiosity, are you agnostic on the environmental impacts of the various energy sources, or is that something you pay attention to in terms of your long-term view?
Oh, that's absolutely critical. Energy is life. I think that's the starting point. I grew up in Sri Lanka where energy access and energy reliability is not as strong. But definitely the energy consumption per capita is materially lower. And one of the kind of leading indicators of quality of life is how much energy that you consume. Right. Mm-hmm. So there is that, right? So I think that's something that a lot of people miss as well, especially people who are comfortable, who have a very high energy consumption, think that Africans or Asians should go without energy for the sake of climate. And that pisses me off a lot.
Understandable.
But the impact is essential. Like, so it's while energy is really good for humans, or harnessing, you know, non-human muscle powered or horse muscle powered energy is really good. And that has had a huge impact on the quality of life. These energy sources have different various impacts. So air pollution, the particulate pollution, and the health impacts thereof is one aspect. Climate impact is paramount in my mind. And I think it's essential that we get to net zero as soon as possible, net zero greenhouse gas emissions from our energy system. But that's not the only thing. There's the environmental social impacts from the kind of throughout the life cycle of these energy sources, what kind of social impacts they have and what environmental impacts they have, not just at the point of consumption, but all the way up to the kind of extraction of the raw materials that go into it.
It's not so recent. In the last couple of years, one of the organizations, a nonprofit that I belong to, I was involved with getting them to transition out of fossil fuel related investments to the extent that that's feasible. And I recognize there's lots of challenges. It's easier said than done. But one of the pushbacks I got from the manager of the funds was that by not investing in fossil fuels, we were possibly not really carrying out our fiduciary responsibilities to the owners of the assets. So what would you say to an investor that came to you and said, well, look, I just want my money in an environment where I can maximize return. And if that includes fossil fuels, well, great, let's do that.
I think the overt insistence on the divestment of fossil investments is a kind of misplaced, priority. Because the emissions happen when we use that energy source, or it's not, emissions are induced from the use of the energy, not from the production of the energy. So if you don't reduce the consumption of that energy and you still buy that energy from somebody else, you're just offshoring that, or you're just saying, hey, in my little island, I don't do this bad thing by fracking or extracting resources, but I just buy it from my neighbor who has to produce it and suffer the kind of whatever the environmental degradation that they, the issue is that with climate, of course, the impact is worldwide because it's our atmosphere, it's a shared resource. I spent a lot of time evaluating New York State's policy of banning fracking. Mm-hmm. So this is something that we said, look, no, we shall not, thou shalt not frack in New York State. Mm-hmm. And yet our consumption of oil and gas, in particular gas, has increased. You know, it's not just like a small increase. It's a huge increase in gas consumption, mostly due to nuclear closures, but also we use more gas and less heating oil in our houses, and we just buy it from Pennsylvania. So, it's the same with, like, if you just say we shall not, I mean, Biden administration is saying no more drilling in the U.S. or no more drilling offshore U.S. And they're going to Venezuela and begging to buy more oil, or going to Saudi Arabia and begging to ask for more oil. It just doesn't compute. The human rights records or the environmental impact in the oil fields in Venezuela or Saudi Arabia are much worse than they are in Pennsylvania or Texas.
Yeah, understood. So I think the big picture there is it's like so much of this climate and environmental related stuff. The devil is in the details to an extent. It's also in the big picture, and it's easy to have a simplified view of things and when digging in is called for. And that's part of what this program is about, is digging in. So let's start digging in a little further into the whole issue of energy and costs. So I've heard you use or seen you use the expression systems cost of electricity. What do you mean by systems cost of electricity?
So the electric system is one of the most amazing machines humans have built. And it is a machine. What goes behind the light switch, when you turn on the light switch for it to come on, when you turn it on, there's the kind of plant level costs of the generating facility. That includes kind of capital depreciation, the fuel, if you're using a fuel source, labor of the people who kind of make that energy happen, and then any kind of security or compliance costs. You know, you have a fence around your facility, and if you have a guard or whatever. So that's plant level. But then beyond the border of the plant, there's the kind of grid level costs. And this could be in the collection infrastructure, if you're talking about like large scale diffused energy sources like solar and wind. There's the transmission from where you generate it to where you need it. And then the distribution network that comes to your house. So that's one part of the grid scale. And then there's storage. There's kind of backup generation. If the source that you thought you had wasn't there, you need some kind of backup generation. And then there's a cost to demand management. I mean, maybe this is not a grid level cost, but a societal cost. But when you say, hey, don't charge your car during these hours, this hour to this hour, there's a cost to that. Especially if you're talking about industry, there's a cost to saying, okay, I'm not going to produce whatever that I'm producing at this time. But these are again system grid level costs. If you think about the whole system level cost, you have to consider the other things we talked about earlier, which is kind of climate impact, kind of biodiversity impacts of whatever the energy source that you are generating, air pollution, or pollution could be air, water, and soil. And then the part of the social cost is the human rights. I mean, this could be the cobalt mining in the DRC or the forced Uyghur labor in China. So all of that adds up to system cost analysis.
So one of the there's a term that I like to use that's kind of wonky, but the term is negative externalities. And so a part of the cost that you're talking about, there are these negative externalities that you just referred to, the social environmental costs. So how can we possibly account for those? And doesn't how we account for them impact the decisions we make on adding energy sources, especially to, you made reference to Africa and Asia. And I'm certainly sympathetic to the point you make there, like, hey, wait a minute. There are a bunch of countries in the West got wealthy burning fossil fuels, and now you're asking us not to burn fossil fuels. I mean, that is kind of crazy on its head. But what about those negative externalities? How do we account for those costs?
So regulation or pricing is one aspect of it. And that is done to some extent. So if you recall, acid rain was a serious concern. And that was due to the kind of the emissions from generation facilities. Sulfur dioxide goes into the atmosphere, becomes sulfuric acid. And regulations came in and said, if you have a generation plant, you have to reduce the emissions of these pollutants. And that actually worked. Acid rain is not a problem anymore. We've done that for the hole in the ozone layer, where mm-hmm. we banned the use of chemical substances that caused the hole in the ozone layer. And we incentivized the investment technologies that provide the same or better service without the externality. The problem with carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases in general, it's foundational to modern industrial society. Right. So the energy is foundational to modern industrial society, and 81% of our primary energy comes from burning stuff. Burning stuff is actually maybe diminishes the problem, in that the problem is extracting virgin fossil hydrocarbon from underground and then emitting the waste into our shared atmosphere. With the ozone layer situation, the cost of the new technology to provide the same service, but didn't have that externality, wasn't huge, and society could bear it, and it was easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
with climate, it's the problem is much bigger and much more fundamental and much more wicked, and it's interconnected, and the different stakeholders have different interests. Primary being, you know, our quality of life is tied to our energy consumption.
Yeah, I like that expression you used, the wicked problem. There's a behavioral economist, Dan Ariely, I heard say that if we were going to design a problem that human beings were especially ill-equipped to deal with, it would be climate change and the related stuff to it. So it is a wicked problem. And so basically I'm hearing you say that the key in terms of the environment is regulatory, and that means political, and that's certainly something that seems to be very obvious as we try and move forward. So let's talk a little bit about wind and solar electricity. What are the implications that you see for transitioning to a fossil fuel free environment? What are the implications of wind and solar from a financial perspective?
So wind and solar costs have come down. This is the kind of plant level costs have come down substantially over the last decade or two. And that's great. We should be deploying a lot of these where the resource potential is high and people want them in their backyards. But asking these kind of intermittent sources to provide energy to power modern industrial society is preposterous. And this is a conclusion that I had difficulty accepting myself, because I wanted wind and solar to be able to provide for societal needs. But the intermittency and the need for electricity in particular to demand to match supply instantaneously is paramount. Mm-hmm. If you think about the freezers that we need to store our vaccines to kind of airlines, or like just think like the discontinuity in service actually causes death in right. many different manners. So then it comes down to the kind of, okay, can't you just store the excess energy from when you have sunlight and wind? I mean, maybe eventually, but definitely not in this century, if that's of interest.
Yeah. So you mentioned solar. And of course, there's the utility scale solar and rooftop solar, which a lot of people think about when they think about solar. And full disclosure, I've got solar on my rooftop. My question is, I've seen data that indicate that rooftop solar probably isn't a very good investment, financially speaking. What are your thoughts on that?
Not sure if that's accurate.
Okay.
The subsidies that the federal and state governments give for solar and wind are so huge that for ratepayers, I think, especially in a high electricity price environment, I think it's a very good deal. I think I can't put solar on my roof because I'm in a multifamily building. Uh-huh. And we are figuring out how to make our roof not leak. as opposed to put solar, but eventually, hopefully. I mean, yeah. my colleague in my neighbor looked at putting solar on their multifamily building, and he said some 85% of the costs were borne by the federal and state subsidies.
So it works, but only because there's federal and state subsidies.
I think it's very dependent on where. So like New York State's solar capacity factor of the installed base of solar on rooftops is only 10%. In California, Southern California, I think that's something like 20%+. In the tropics, it's probably even higher. So in India, it makes a ton of sense to do a lot of solar. In Germany, it doesn't. Though they have that. So, I mean, there's two sides of things. One is, it is, again, back to that kind of developed world / developing world dichotomy. I think it is incumbent upon the developed world to deploy and scale up these technologies so that the rest of the world can afford them, right? There's a learning curve. The more you deploy, the more the costs come down. And so the world owes Germany a debt where they don't have a lot of actual usable solar, but they invested in solar in a big way such that the costs have come down. Now Indonesians and Qataris can deploy it on their roofs cheaper.
Okay, well, that's an interesting point. So I'll give myself a small pat on the back for being part of the process of making solar more affordable all around the world. You made a reference to California. Let's jump there for a second. One of the things I came across in getting ready for this conversation, you had provided a chart showing the cost of electricity in California versus the cost of electricity on average in the rest of the United States. And I was really shocked, to tell you the truth. I think that the cost in California was up around 17, 18 cents per kilowatt hour, way above the average cost in the United States. So why is electricity so expensive in California, especially given all of the solar that they use there?
So I think this goes to the level of solar and wind penetration. California is one of the states with the highest penetration of variable renewable generation. And that goes to the kind of grid level cost, because ratepayers are ultimately responsible for, I guess, the grid level cost as opposed to the social and system level cost. So that includes the transmission lines, the storage, the backup generation. And when you have a small amount of renewable penetration, variable renewable penetration, so hydro is different, geothermal is different, because they are steady sources of energy. The moment you have a variable generation penetration get beyond, say, 20-30%, the rest of the infrastructure that has to accommodate for when the solar goes down, sun goes down, there's a cost to that, and that cost adds up. And I think that's part of the cost increase in California. But Texas's renewable, especially wind and solar generation penetration is very high, I think high or higher than California's. But Texas hasn't had that same level of cost increase there. So I'm not quite sure how all that adds up, but it is very apparent in places with high renewable penetration, variable renewable penetration, the grid level costs go up after a certain level of penetration. So so California is one other anecdote on California is that people are buying diesel backup generation for when the grid is becoming less reliable. And even on the grid, California asked the federal government an exemption for burning fossil, so that they could build these new gas and diesel generators to make sure the grid stays online for when there's a shortage of variable renewable generation. So, and I think Germany is another clear example where kind of ideology-driven insistence on a solar wind-only grid has brought them to their knees. Industrial capacity in Europe, across Europe and Germany, is shutting down in a major way. And that's a function of energy costs being too expensive to bear.
Well, that's a very interesting problem you put forward there. And I just want to say as an aside, advocates for wind and solar are fond of saying, well, once we install the panels, once we install the windmills, that the energy source then is free, sunlight and wind. But it sounds like it's not anywhere near that simple. As there's greater and greater penetration of those sources of energy, it becomes more and more expensive to maintain the grid so that we can have a reliable source of electricity. So am I doing a, do I get it? Is that a good summary?
Yeah, I think, this is a very big subject and I am still in the process of learning a lot of these things. But yes, I think the scientific consensus and practical reality of what's happening in across Europe today, and the evidence is clear. So Germany has, the Energy Wende program invested over 500 billion euros to build solar, wind, and other renewable technologies. And they have one of the dirtiest grids in Europe because they have to, when the sun is not shining and the wind is not blowing, they have to rely on the dirtiest form of coal to keep the lights on.
So if somebody said, well, while that's the case, and I do see that it is the case, that this is just strictly transitional and sooner or later we'll be able to power our grid with those renewable resources, would that be a fair thing to say?
I think it is possible if you are South Australia, because South Australia is a small enough grid next to a much larger grid that they can draw upon. Effectively, they're using their neighbors as a battery. And if you actually had to build that battery yourself, the cost becomes exponential. I'm a storage investor. I think we're going to need lots of storage for not just electric vehicles, but also grid level storage. But if you just add up the numbers, the amount of storage that exists or that can be deployed today to the amount of electricity that we use on a moment by moment basis, it is mind blowing.
Yep, a lot of bucks we're talking about there. So let's poke into the future a bit here. 2050, of course, is bandied around a lot about some kind of time target to keep our eye on. And so whatever we do, if we're going to get to net zero by 2050, that's going to require really massive amounts of money be spent. I mean, before I get to my full question, I mean, is that true? I mean, we're going to have to spend a lot of money, right?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have to spend a lot of money, and some of that is upfront and some of that is ongoing. We need to invest in our future, right? So that's something that we must do.
So how much do we have to spend?
That I am not able to. I'm a very kind of microeconomist or micro like company level research. And all these kind of major global level projections have a huge amount of assumptions embedded within it. And I've seen how those even small changes in those assumptions can sway things back and forth in a major way. So just one thing, maybe one anecdote or one piece of evidence that might help is Bloomberg New Energy Finance evaluated that about $900 billion of clean energy investments were made in 2021. I think about 150 of that was in clean tech company investments, and the rest of it was in deployments. So solar, wind, nuclear, batteries, EVs, etc.
And that's in the United States we're talking about.
Oh, that's a global number.
Oh, that's a global number. Okay. Well, it's
$1 trillion per annum per, what is current. But that's going up and that's great. I think we need, once you incentivize the investment by kind of guaranteeing some kind of return or providing the incentive, I think climate finance will come. And what's lacking currently is kind of coherent policies and a kind of political will to act.
So just speaking as a layperson, it seems unlikely that governments around the world are going to be able to come up with $1 trillion a year between now and 2050. So if governments can't do that, it seems like the private sector is going to be a significant player in financing all these changes we have to make. So do you think that's a fair statement? And what is it, if it is, what is it that gets private investors to invest in this sort of thing?
I mean, what private investors always want, I mean, private investors, it kind of demonized by, I guess, many, but they're just your grandfather and his retirement fund, right? They're your retirement fund. They're pools of capital that are available for deployment. And what the governments can do is set the right policies in place to incentivize that capital to get into energy. I mean, over the last decade, we were all kind of blinded by the shale revolution that happened in the US, Canada to some extent, in that energy was so cheap that that kind of lost track of a lot of things, I think. But with higher energy prices, I think there's an energy realism that's setting in, that we need to put money into these energy sources and start kind of doing it for real.
Yeah, so I think just to sum up in my own layperson way, what I think I heard you just say, and that is that, well, a combination of what you said and what I said. So there's a lot of money that needs to be invested, and government can't underwrite it all. And that's going to call for private investment, private monies. And the role of government in that is setting policies that make those kind of investments attractive. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I mean, I think you and I are both promoters of this notion of a price on carbon, so that the right kind of investments are made across the board, across the economy. I mean, we spoke most of, you know, we are currently focusing on mostly on the electricity sector, but electricity is only one quarter of responsible right. for one quarter of emissions. I mean, we need to get to steel making and fertilizer making yeah. and cement and all these other things that have huge climate impact. And we haven't even scratched the surface of how to cost-effectively decarbonize these sectors, which is not to say that the promising technology isn't being invested, isn't there or anything like that. But the electricity is only the first and probably the easiest piece. And we are not doing too well on that so yeah. far, so let alone get to these other more harder things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe just follow up on sure. your earlier question is one of the things that we are doing well is things like green banks, where in some stats, a green bank is a kind of a public institution that says, I'm going to put in a dollar, and then they can, and some of them have a multiplier effect of getting private capital to put in like $7 or $10 for each dollar that they put in. And that's with simple things like you get the ratepayers to pay, like get a fraction of what the ratepayers pay for electricity, or maybe you can do this for gasoline as well, where you get the money upfront. So it's like a guarantee mechanism so that the private investor knows that they'll get paid. So it's a risk mitigation mechanism that the Green Bank puts in place that attracts a ton of other people to come in and invest. So in Canada, this happened recently. A government-owned entity called Ontario Power Generation owns this nuclear power plant called Bruce Power, and they put out bond interest for bonds where private capital, so this would be municipalities or other, like, private capital can bid into buying some of their bonds. And the private capital interest for this 300 million Canadian bond issuance, the private capital interest was six times the amount of capital that was needed.
Wow.
So it's like you have a good product and you have a good kind of comfort level for the investors that they'll get their money back. They'll put money in.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Green Bank thing is something kind of new on my radar. I mean, I believe there's considerations for establishing green banks in the IRA 2022. Is that right?
That has been talked about. I haven't read that part of the IRA. I think it might be there. Okay. That's been talked about. We have been advocating for that for a while. There is a green bank in New York. I'm not sure in I know there isn't one at the federal level, but we definitely want that.
Yeah, for sure. So just as we're getting close to finish here, but I want to ask you one thing specifically. I know from my getting ready for our conversation that you are an advocate of using nuclear power to make up for this issue of intermittency of wind and solar. So let's just talk about the costs, the financial costs of nuclear power for a second, because the data I look at shows that right now in the United States that nuclear electricity is pretty expensive. So is that the case? And if so, how does that fit into expanding our nuclear capabilities?
Nuclear has a very low operating cost. The most of nuclear cost is in the construction side of things. Once they are built, the nuclear capacity that we have, it's about 20% of U.S. electricity is nuclear, about 50% of our carbon-free electricity is from nuclear. Few nuclear plants did shut down in this kind of shale gas-induced madness that we went through in the last decade. When the gas, so gas basically sets the marginal price of electricity in so-called deregulated electricity markets. So these are ISO, RTO regions where the price is bidded. So gas sets the marginal price, and gas was so cheap that it didn't make sense for any other energy technology to, no other energy technology made money. Except if they were massively subsidized, as in the case of solar and wind. So hydro, probably cheapest, nuclear, probably next cheapest. But the world has changed, right? Like, so now with the war in Europe and the kind of shale revolution coming to an end to some extent, the attractiveness of nuclear has increased substantially. The IRA, for the first time, is granting nuclear the same level of production tax credits and investment tax credits that solar and wind have enjoyed for more than a decade. So what that means is that existing nuclear plants can actually get rewarded for their carbon-free generation. So back to your question of building new nuclear. There's multiple avenues. So the federal government is doing these demonstration plants, both in Wyoming, in Washington state, and kind of advancing new technologies, which promise kind of to convert this paradigm from like nuclear plants being from a kind of being like a airport which is massive construction project, to be more like an airplane, which is a you build it at a factory and then you kind of send it out into the world. And that promises to be substantially cheaper. And things like investing in the fuel cycle, the federal government is also, with the IRA, is also providing support for that so that we kind of bring some of that onshore and be ready for advanced technologies that can, for instance, reuse the existing spent nuclear fuel, also known as nuclear waste.
Yeah.
So we can use it, you know, 5-10 times more as opposed to just dump it in some hole in the ground.
Yep. Well, one of the things that you've highlighted for me, Isuru, is the idea of digging deeper into our subjects. It's so easy for us as lay people to develop an opinion and just hang on to that over time. And I don't think we can, that's a luxury that we can no longer afford. And I really appreciate you digging into this subject of money and clean energy and so on. So as we finish up here, anything else you would like to add before we close?
I'd say the signs are good. So the IRA, I think, changed the world in many ways. It's the largest investment from a government on clean tech. The EU's green taxonomy is also setting the kind of incentives aligned so that the private capital can put money into all sorts of low carbon technology, including nuclear. Private companies, for instance, Dow Chemical is partnering with another advanced nuclear company to kind of decarbonize some of those harder to do industrial heat applications, which solar and wind are not capable of. I think there's a lot happening around the world. And I think, you know, what people have to do or what states have to do is kind of open their eyes to what's happening around the world and kind of be participants in this race to net zero, because we need all solutions and we need all solutions to be deployed as soon as possible. And it's not just electricity, as mentioned, it's across the board. I think what the Inflation Reduction Act doesn't have still is a kind of a border adjustment process.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So we don't shut down our industries here and buy high carbon inputs from the rest of the world. So that's something that we will keep fighting for.
Yeah, so you're finishing us up here on somewhat of an optimistic note, which I appreciate. And there's an immense amount of work to be done. Border adjustment for carbon intensive imports is certainly big on the agenda. And you made the comment that states all around the world have to be focused on this. And I will say at the same time that each of us as individuals and the groups we belong to need to be focused on it too. It's a massive problem. So Isiru, I appreciate so much you being with us today. I appreciate your perspective and I've learned a lot. So thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, John.
So many thanks to Isiru Senavaratna for joining us today and giving us some insights into the dollars and cents of addressing climate change. I'll just finish up by saying that it's absolutely necessary that we take a clear-eyed look at the costs of both addressing and not addressing climate change if we are to be successful in creating a healthy future. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out, a bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under programming. So until we talk again, remember that all great victories were almost great defeats, and always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.